The goals and realities of the industrial era are obsolete. If they persist, they may actually further threaten a world where the environment's already unstable, economic and social inequities abound, and modern weaponry puts us all at risk. New directions, new goals, and a new way of thinking must be found if we are to cope with what Robert Theobald calls the rapids of change, the fundamental changes of our time rushing throughout the nation and the world. Today on Conversations, we talk with the man who calls himself a hopeful realist, socioeconomist, author, and futurist, Robert Theobald. Perhaps the best first question is, what's wrong or obsolete with the social and economic structures that have fueled the industrial and now the post-industrial era?
Well, I think there are two primary forces which we have to change. The first is that when we run into people who differ from us, our first reaction is to get angry and to get violent. And we're going to be living in an increasingly diverse world, and therefore we can't afford to do that. There are two reactions you can have when you run into somebody who says, no, that's not the way I see it. You can say, you're wrong, which is a typical reaction, particularly from the dominant cultures of the world. Or you can say, hey, that's great. This person is looking at the same things as I am, but he's got a different way of looking at it. I can learn. I can be creative. So for me, one of the steps is to move from a situation where conflict produces violence to one where conflict produces creativity. And a great deal of the roundtable work which we're doing throughout the state now is designed to teach the people the skills of working with each other creatively. The other shift that we've got to make is that ecological systems will not allow maximum growth rates anymore. And that's obvious, except we're not doing very much about it. Even the best reports, like the Brundtland report, which has come out and talked about the change we need, says, well, we have to care about the ecology, but we can still have maximum economic growth. And to be blunt, it's nonsense. We're going to have to change. Now, the only way I can see to change is to go beyond democracy. Democracy is a very primitive form of and method of doing governance in the way we now want it. We're going to have to learn how to work with each other creatively rather than just have ritualized conflict, which is what democracy is.
Well, we're going to use this next hour to talk about the topics you've raised gradually and appointed a time, I think. But
having thrown the whole kitchen sink at them, right?
Absolutely right. Well, we'll give some things for our listeners to think about. The industrial era has created a system which is based on continual economic growth. We feel secure as a nation, and other Western nations also feel secure when they are engaged in continual upward economic growth. It's brought us to a very uncomfortable place in your perspective.
Well, but it's more than that. We haven't really had growth since the mid-70s. People are still pretending that we've had growth, but the fact is that if you exclude a very small proportion of the population, which is the top 1 or 10%, most people have been losing ground. Particularly young people between the ages of 25 and 35 have been losing ground. Children have been losing a lot of ground. Working class people have been losing a lot of ground. The middle class have been losing ground. The rich have been doing fine, thank you. I do not believe we will ever see growth again. So it's not a matter in the way we've seen it. That was a period, a short period between 1950 and 1970, 1975. But it was a freak. And now we're going to have to get used to living with not more than the standard of living. And so what we've got to do is move beyond a concentration of the standard of living to a concentration on the quality of life.
We are living in many ways then on a memory, and a brief memory at that.
We're living on a memory and a brief memory, and this is particularly true in Alaska, because Alaska got very rich for a while, and now people are beginning to say, we aren't that rich, we're going to have to learn to live with less, and the Hickel administration is trying to get people to concentrate on the fact that there's going to have to be a cutback in the levels of government service. That's a very difficult message to send in any state, and it's happening all over but it's particularly happening here. The state got fat in the oil boom, and it clearly has expectations which are unrealistic in the sort of world we're going to be living in.
Let me take a moment to introduce you now that you've thrown out a provocative thought or two. You've probably perked up an ear.
One of my lines is, be very careful not to get hung up on the first thing you dislike. I'm sure I'll have other for you during the hour.
All right. We're listening to Conversations today. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. With me today is Robert Theobald. The gentleman was born in India in 1929. He is a socioeconomist, having gained an MA in economics from Cambridge University in 1952. Did further studies at Harvard in the years 57 and 58. He's the author of over 15 books, some of the titles, Beyond Despair, Avoiding 1984, The Challenge of Abundance, and his most recent book, The Rapids of Change, published in 1987. Mr. Theobald is a community consultant, is the founder of an organization called Action Linkage. We'll tell you more about that later on. You wrote in The Rapids of Change about eight driving forces that you said were changing the face of the earth. We're changing the face of reality. I don't know whether you need to describe in detail the driving forces, but give us a picture. Why is it changing?
Well, there are a lot of them, but let's start with population. Population both internally, because the baby boom is still working through, we're going to see a very rapidly changing population picture. A new wrinkle on that, which most people haven't caught up with, is we have another baby boom happening. We're almost back up to the rates of birth that we had in the peak period, the 50s. And believe it or not, we will get caught again, and we will not have enough kindergartens for those kids. I mean, you'd think at least we could keep up with something as obvious and as visible as that. But you've also got the world population picture. Despite what everybody said, we have not begun to get the world population increase under control. And you now have countries like Bangladesh, which are so crowded that when you have a natural disaster, you kill people in the hundreds of thousands. You have China, which says we cannot afford to have more than one child per couple. People talk about, well, what happens when all of those spoiled children grow up to be adults? And it's a very interesting issue. You've got the whole technology issue. You've got something called virtual reality, which is in this week's Fortune. And virtual reality is the capacity to use computers to produce a world which looks real but isn't real.
Translate.
Well, I can build for you a picture using goggles and headphones and a glove, and I can make you believe that you're standing in the town of Seattle when you're not.
Like a hologram.
It's a hologram which is totally real. So if I turn my head, the hologram goes with me. And we are going to have that as an incredibly complex technology just 10 years out from now. They are talking about virtual sex so that you can have sex with your partner when you're away, which is a whole interesting and technical issue.
All right, let me stop for a pivotal question. We can tell by just thinking about it what some of the consequences of a population explosion are, or a continuing explosion as it is worldwide. What are some of the negative consequences that you see, the dangers ahead, the things we don't anticipate from a technological revolution?
Technology is basically confronting us with a set of issues that we don't think about. I didn't talk yet about the whole birth set of birth issues. One of my frustrations is we're getting hung up on abortion when that, in a sense, is the easiest of all of the questions we're going to face. Do we have surrogate parenthood? Under what conditions do we have surrogate parenthood? If you look at do we allow the transfer of body parts? People are already flying off to India in order to find a kidney from somebody who cannot afford not to take the offer to buy one of their kidneys. You combine the ability to choose the birth of children with the preference for males in India, you're going to change the whole pattern of how many male and how many women are born. I mean, you can just go on for hours in terms of how technology gives us new choices. The most dramatic of all is that technology means that death is no longer decided by God, if that is your image, or by natural forces. It's decided by doctors. if that's true, at some point we have to make choices about when death is permitted to happen.
We're not anywhere near morally evolved enough or conscious enough to deal with the ethics of these situations at this point.
Well, we aren't, but we have to be. And in fact, we've made much more progress than we think. Hospice is an effective system which allows people to make that those choices, but people don't like those choices being made. And a lot of the work, therefore, that I am doing is trying to recreate the middle. What you have at the moment is the nuts and the crazies on both sides of issues who dominate the debate. And I'm saying that there is already a group of people, which we call the isolated many, who are very competent, but who have no space in which to say, I don't want this argument to go on this way. I was just down at Juno, and there's an argument going on, which I'm sure is even reverberated up here on the new AJ mine. Well, that is being driven on one extreme by the crazy developers and on the other extreme by the crazy environmentalists, and the people in the middle who say, look, we would really like to settle this for the good of Juno are getting left out. One of the things I hope happened out of my visit just recently was that some of the people in the middle said, well, we need to start talking to each other and thinking about how you isolate the extremists on both sides of that issue.
And internationally, you think that we are capable of doing the same thing. Currently, internationally, we do seem to be, as you introduced the thought at the beginning of the program, face off with each other and saying, I don't like your ideas, I don't like you, backing away.
I don't know if, look, as I look at the future as a rational analyst, I will tell you that the least probable future is a hopeful future. If, I mean, you know, the natural, intelligent thing to do is to extrapolate the mess we're doing and to assume we're going to go on doing the same thing. The reason I don't think that has to happen is because I know there are enough bright and creative people who would not like that to happen. It's not that people aren't aware of the need for change. We've reached that point. That's what I've watched in the 25, 30 years I've been at this. What now happens is people come up to me and say, Bob, you're right, but we're not going to do anything about it. And that sort of frustrates me. So I don't think it's going to happen. I know it can happen. And really the challenge I'm putting out to the people we're talking to is, are you going to get to be part of the process by which we deal with these issues, or are you going to continue to sit by and say, well, things are going to hell in a handbasket, but I can't do anything. It's not my business.
This is a message of the 60s. Are you part of the solution or part of the problem?
Yes, except that it is not a violent solution. You see, the 60s, if we made this message, we would have then said, go and picket the president or the chancellor or the town council. And now I say, go and work with those people. Go and help them to see that there are other solutions. Because wherever I go, I find people are hungry for new ideas, willing to look at new directions. But most of us who are in the change business are still in the business of showing how bright we are rather than working with people. And I have a very simple graffiti in the Rapids of Change. You can either get social change, you can get credit for it, but you can't have both. Most change agents are still in the business of getting credit for social change.
Why are the 90s important? Is this a time of crisis? We can see it internationally and in some ways nationally. Why is it a time of opportunity?
Well, we can see it, and it's not only in some ways. I mean, look at the savings and loan crisis. $500 billion, that started at 35, I think it was. It's probably up to, I'm probably behind, it's probably 6 or 7 by now. That's a fairly substantial crisis.
And the banks behind them.
And the banks behind them and the insurance companies behind them. I think that our culture, one of my deep beliefs, is just because communism has failed, that does not mean that capitalism isn't in almost as deep problems. I think our culture isn't working. The whole economic system is much more fragile than anybody is willing to admit. And the social system is in deep problems. We have more people in jail than in any other democratic country. Our vital indicators like birth rates, I mean, like how many people die as children, as infants, are way down the list. And if you look at, if you then compare blacks and whites, the life expectancy for black males actually fell in the last couple of years. And we say how terrible that is when that happens in Russia, but we don't look at our own figures. We have a crisis which is extraordinarily serious. New York is just about to fall apart because they don't know where to find the money to deal with that city. And the people I know say, well, New York is just the leading edge of the breakdown of all of the major cities in the United States. So the 90s for me are the date, the period in which we will either look at new solutions, new directions, fundamental ones, so that we go into what I call the compassionate era or rather than the industrial era, or I deeply believe that problems will have become essentially insoluble and that our kids, our grandkids, are going to be living in a world I would not choose for them.
Let's take a look at this issue about capitalism following communism as two economic systems that are in decline. You've pointed out ways where you see our system is in decline. Is it the basic structure, as we accuse the basic structure of communism as being inept?
Yes, because our basic flaw is this is a culture of greed and materialism. We have been brought to be consumers instead of citizens. The way we have been valued over the last 40 years is how much do you buy, not how much do you participate, how much are you involved. And it won't work. I was reading Fortune on the way up. There are now, I think it is 700,000 personal bankruptcies a year. Corporations are failing at an enormous rate. The system is instable. We have just reached the point where everything is sort of right on the edge of failure. But the real problem is that people don't want to be consumers anymore. People are now talking about the quality of life. They're saying that isn't where they want to be. And so we have a culture which is designed to deliver one set of success criteria, one set of satisfactions, and people are saying that's not what we want out of life. We want something quite different. And we can't deliver that within the current system.
Two questions come immediately to mind, and I'll try and space them out here. The one is a statement, I suppose, a question to you about the resistance of the system. If indeed one looks at the United States and says your economic system is insupportable, that system and the people behind it will scream like a stuck pig. We have invested 260 million plus people strong our lives in that system.
Well, so did the Russians. The point is that, well, I mean, that was a slick answer, I'm sorry. But basically, the fact is that as I go around this country and as I talk to people, everybody, with very rare exceptions, knows we're in crisis and is looking for a new way out. And that includes bankers. It includes top managers. This is not a message which really is as controversial as it sounds. You talk to businesses. They say we cannot do top-down management anymore, which is really what I'm saying about the culture. You talk to managers. They say we have got to learn to manage the environment differently. So that more and more of them are talking about how do you recycle waste. It's not really a dramatic message, and in a sense, when it's put the way I put it, it was, but people know this. People know that the system isn't working and are ready to change. The problem is we've not been doing a good job of helping people to see how they can do this. Now, I think we've got to make a real interesting distinction. The system is going to get very nervous. Many people in the systems are going to be very happy. How do you free people out of the system so that it can happen? It's also true of the university. The university has exactly the same set of problems. How do you free those people or the school system so that they can change their success criteria without losing their jobs, without losing their money, et cetera, et cetera?
And without blowing up the system that, however crippled it may be, does support
that's right.
The well, economy or the education.
This is a very old image of mine. You've got to rebuild Grand Central while keeping the trains running. Now, there's some of my colleagues who believe that the answer is simply to allow the system to collapse and hope that something will be there afterwards. I cannot believe this. The system is too complex, too fragile to have a major collapse and hope we'll come out of it. What we have to recognize, there's this old story about the frog, that you put it in cold water, and if you raise the temperature sufficiently gradually, it doesn't jump out. And I keep on wondering if this is true, but I've never met anybody who tells me it isn't. But I think that's where we are. The temperature is now about 80 degrees centigrade. And, you know, people say to me, but Bob, it won't happen until we have a crisis. And I say, what more do you want to have a crisis? You have large areas of Washington, D.C., which are no-go areas because of drugs. Isn't that a crisis? You have kids who are not learning. Isn't that a crisis? You have incredible number of crack babies. Isn't that a crisis? You have kids being born with wet brain. You go out into the territories with the natives, and you will find 20 and 30% of those kids being born with alcoholic wet brain. Isn't that a crisis? What does it take us to recognize we're in a crisis?
But what we're doing in reaction to that is buying more locks for the door, putting more police on the streets, putting more people in prison, starting more alcohol programs in response to the various ones you've mentioned. We're still tinkering with the Titanic, yes?
Yeah, well, I have this thing I call the Titanic quiz. And we are moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic, which doesn't seem very logical to me. But you see, the paradox here, in, what was it, 1854, both of the political parties were seen to be irrelevant, and a group of people got together and created the Republican Party. It won 6 years later. I think we have to realize that both Democrats and Republicans are both working out of a totally obsolete set of images. Now, this time, I don't think it's a national party. What I think we have to do is to revive community government. Basically, we have to start saying, look, we're not willing to put up with the level of government most communities are getting. And that's mainly because citizens have not been supporting their politicians. So politicians say, we're not going to run for that amount of grief. And so the politicians don't do well, so the citizens get even madder. So you have a declining spiral. And we now do not have the best people in office in most communities.
So one of the solutions you're offering is citizen leadership.
It is basically saying communities have to be run by citizens. And this whole movement we're creating in the state called the Roundtable Movement is about getting citizens back to believing that they can make a difference in their own communities.
Once again, we're talking to Bob Theobald. He is, in one of his guises, a community consultant and has worked for communities both urban and rural in Illinois, Washington, Nebraska, the state of Alaska, Wisconsin, Hawaii, Arizona, and Texas, among others. This roundtable approach has been taken in some of these, in other communities who work with education, transportation, various departments and divisions of the community. So one of the things you are proposing then is if the political system, for example, is not working, then we should step aside from that system to create small community-based systems that may indeed work on a community level?
Well, look at how what went wrong. The reason power went to Washington was because communities were not willing to make tough choices. So we went to the feds, and the feds said, well, if you won't do it, we'll do it. If you want to get power back out of the system, I see no other way than communities begin to say, well, we want that power back. And I don't think that the first approach is to go to Washington and try and to sell that model. There's too much power in Washington. I think it'll be helpful if we have people there. And in fact, I did write a book about a third party winning. But the more I worked on that, the more convinced I became that that third party has to essentially come out of community work, maybe state work. In other words, I could imagine third parties coming earlier at a state level than at a national level at the moment.
Many of the issues that confront us are not community issues, though. They're not even regional. They are national
issues. Give me an example.
An example would be environmental concerns. Can a city on a river deal with its toxic waste when the toxic waste is flowing down from the community upriver?
Well, but I'm going to give you a different cut at it, and I think it's the key cut for this upcoming Brazil conference, and I'm afraid I know which way it's going to go. You can either assume that the way to resolve the environmental issue is to pass more laws, have more government control, and hope it'll work that way, or you can begin to get citizens so involved with this that it is not going to pay to have that factory upstream polluting the river, because the amount of pressure on that firm is so great that they realize that they're not doing themselves any good. Now, it's obviously got to be a mix of those. But our problem at the moment is we believe that legislation control is the way to manage this. And I don't think that's going to work. It's going to happen as people change their mind about the real importance of the environment. Now, we've seen some fascinating things happen. A great deal of our green marketing is pretty shallow. The firms have jumped onto that, you know. So, and we have all sorts of fascinating arguments. So is a cloth diaper or a disposable the better thing to do?
Is the paper fact, or plastic?
And basically, as you look at all those, they're real washouts, because the real issue is you've got to decrease the amount of waste and the amount of use. And in a sense, those are marginal gains. And I think one of the things we're going to have to face up to is that the amount of throughput, the amount you can afford to produce, use, and throw away has to be decreased. That just isn't enough to go around. Take the energy issue. We are going to be forced to increase the price of energy very significantly. This is the only country, I believe, in the world that has gas at anything like the price it is here. Europe is 3 to 4 times the price. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is we don't care about our kids. We're saying it doesn't matter that our kids aren't going to have any gas. And in fact, this is one of my real interesting issues in Alaska. Why are we so urgent to get the, I mean, even if Anwar is right and it should be tapped, why are we so urgent to get it out now rather than since wait when until it'll be more needed? Because what we're really saying is be as profligate as we want to for as long as we possibly can, and then we have a crash, which seems to me not a very bright way of looking at it.
I want to go back to the stuck pig that screams for a minute. When you talk about reducing the amount of consumer items we consume so that we can reduce waste, so that on the front end of the wagon we reduce the burden that we place on the environment and on the economy, what about the people who are employed in those very industries that are creating what we are calling eventual waste? I'm thinking here also of the people in the lumber industry who are threatened when the spotted owl is taken care of, the people who work for the nuclear industry who said, no, we want to go back to work regardless of the toxic dangers.
Well, if you want to eat, you want a job in this culture. We need to change the rules so that the way we hand out money is not tied in the same way as it was in the industrial society. Basically, we are getting to a point where, in a very real sense, more and more of the jobs will make work jobs. If we said we want people to spend as little time on the job rather than as much time, there are many, many people who argue that 33% of the labor in most of our systems is not needed. But we can't afford to do that because everybody needs a job. So long as you say that the only way you can get money is to do a job, then you cannot afford to say to anybody, no, we're not going to produce. The same argument about why we cannot cut back on military expenditure. So that's what drives you into the model of how do you rethink the socioeconomic system so that it changes. Now, there are lots of ways to change it. One of them is to cut the number of hours, which I don't think is the best route. Another one is to ask why we got caught up in something we call maximum labor force participation. Now, this gets tricky with women around, because for me there were two levels when women went into the labor force. There were people who went in and they said, we want in, we want to do this stuff. And then in the last 5 to 10 years, there have been a whole new generation who have gone in because they just can't,
no choice.
Can't make it without that. Sure. And I would like to free up both men and women so that there don't have to be two people in the labor force. So I would like to start saying, well, there are times when I argue that we should be trying for full unemployment. I think jobs are a lousy way to get work done.
Can you build for us an economic system that works?
I think that we can imagine an economic system where our primary goal is not the economic system, but it is the quality of life. You see, free markets are a good idea so long as you start taking the power out of the free market. I mean, what we now say is we'll have free markets, but we're going to give the corporations power, we're going to give the unions power. We're not going to have free movement of information or accurate movement of information, and the government is going to distort the economy. Now, when you have that, you benefit the rich as against the poor. If you begin to take those distortive factors out of there, the free market really is the best way to determine what is a fair exchange rate between things.
Because you and I can decide.
And it is a fair bargain.
Right.
Because I don't have the power to say, well, now, if it's a famine and I have the food and you don't, that ain't a fair bargain, and that's an extreme case. But it's the same thing that why I'm not a free trade person is the developing countries do much worse than the developed countries in that trading. So we are taking resources away from the developing countries.
Do some more building for me on this economy that would work.
Well,
it has to include the environment.
It's got to include the environment. Part of this really takes us into the university, because the problem is that 95% of the work in the university, and I'm being kind, is being used to prop up the obsolete industrial system. If we started to use some people who would think about where we were really going rather than pretending that nothing is changing, we would be able to answer your question a lot better than we can at the moment, because Bob Theobald by himself, or even with a very few people trying to work on this, is not bright enough to look at what it's going to take. But I think some of the keys are some radical changes in the economic, in the taxation system, so that you tax consumption instead of income.
Hmm. I buy a Cadillac, I pay more than if I buy a loaf of bread.
Right. The reason people don't like that is because you then increase regressive taxation, even if you charge more for the Cadillac than you do for the Honda. So I propose abolishing all Social Security, which is really now simply another taxation system, which is extraordinarily regressive because you pay it from the first dollar, and you incorporate that into the income tax system. And the income tax system is significantly progressive. Really do believe you need a progressive tax system. Now, that's an argument that people get into. But I think in a world where we recognize that there are restrictions on how much you can purchase because of the environment, we are going to have to recognize that gaps like we have now between income are intolerable. One statistic most people don't know is that about 10 years ago, the chief executive made about 23 times the amount that a worker made. It is now 99.
Chief executive makes 99 times what a worker makes.
Right. And that's a trend we've got. And it's a very unhealthy trend. The very rich are getting very much richer, and the rich are getting much richer. And we can't afford that gap to open up. So I think we're going to have to go back to how do you close those gaps down.
I want to recap for just a minute so we can take a next step here. In the last 30 minutes or so, you have talked about the importance of attending to the issue of population, out-of-control population, and that, I would assume, includes, not parenthetically, the issue of starvation around the world. You've talked about the fact that we need to attend to environmental issues before we are engulfed by them. You have talked about the fact that we have an economy on this side of the world as well as on the other side of the world that is in great danger, and we have to change the way that economy is structured. You have also said that we can't do this it is inefficient to do this by imposing law and regulation upon the people.
Yes, I have a proposal that we have special sessions of the legislature to repeal legislation.
On the positive side, you have said that you have great faith in the people to make the changes that need to be made if we are going to survive ourselves on this planet. How do the people, whether it is around this city or around this nation or around this world, come to what has to be a transformation in thinking in order to take that next step?
Well, you see, I think it's the wrong question. Let me explain why. People have made a transformation in their thinking, but they believe that they're isolated.
I can't do anything. I'm just one person.
No, it's more than that. I believe that my stance is not the stance of other people, therefore I am crazy, or therefore it's too risky.
I think something's wrong, but everybody else thinks it's fine because everybody else is going shopping.
That's right. So you have what I call the how are you fine, how are you really syndrome. If you ask how are you really, you're probably
going
to get 2 hours on what's really going on and you don't want to hear. It's very much, it seems to me, that way in the culture. When people are asked how they feel about President Bush's presidency, they say 75%, 80%, yes, it's fine. When you go out and talk to them, they give you a totally different answer. There was a very recent column about this. There is a degree of skepticism and frustration in the culture which is unbelievable. So that on my poll where I ask people how bad they think they are on things are on a scale from 0 through 10, as I mentioned, people are in the 7 through 9 range. What we need to do is not anymore to convince people that change is needed. We need to provide spaces in which they can talk comfortably about what changes they think we need to make. And that's what this roundtable process, which we've started in Alaska, is doing. It is a place where you can come, and this is in Fairbanks on Wednesday mornings at 7, you can come and talk with other people who are willing to talk with, assuming that you are making sense, assuming that you're not crazy, and there is a rule that you don't cut other people down. So that people can begin to find out that they are not the only person seeing the need for fundamental change. And a whole Anchorage has been running somewhat longer than Fairbanks, but the level of sort of ideas and dreams and visions that emerge from this is extraordinary, because when I did this in the 60s, people looked at me and said, Bob, you've got two heads. Totally crazy. This is never going to happen. Now people just need the opportunity to say, oh, yeah, it's got to change, but I just don't see how to do it. Now, the other piece on that, and it's a real interesting one, is that an awful lot of 60s people have given up hope. And I saw an extreme example of this. It was a guy who has become a superintendent. And I went into that group, and I forced him to look at the fact he could do something. And I really got worried about him committed suicide. Because having to go back out of the despair, the frozenness, the, oh, well, you know, I can't do it, therefore I have an excuse for being irresponsible. Or no, it wasn't being irresponsible. I'll do what the job calls for. When I said, but if you do something else than that, you can bring about changes. And a friend of mine called Bob Stilger has a wonderful line that helps to keep me sane. He says, big changes don't happen because one person does something dramatic. It happens because a lot of people do a lot of things a little bit differently. So what we all need to begin to do is to start thinking about what we do. Let's take consumption. We really need to recognize that every dollar we spend is a vote for the particular thing we spend it for. If you take Time magazine, you are saying that that's the sort of information you want. There are other magazines which come out of the sorts of things I'm talking about. There's a magazine called In Context, which is a wonderful magazine about what sorts of dreams and visions and thinking we need. When you pay for that, that's an organization, because they've always been in trouble, which is still in trouble and begins to wonder if it can work. And you've cast your vote for that group and you keep that group alive. When you say that I take more magazines, I am willing to bet you that 80% of your readers take more magazines than they can read. That's pure waste. One of the first things they ought to do is to say, I'm going to cut those subscriptions. And I'm going to either save that money or I'm going to use that money for something else. We are not willing to look at overload. We continue to pretend that we are not overloaded, rather than saying, well, I can only use so many, read so many magazines, so why buy them all? There are only 24 hours in a day. You know, that's one of the few things that isn't going to change.
We are a nation, I think, that still looks for the strapping young handsome man on the white horse that is going to solve our problems. You are saying there's no guy.
There is. I mean, that's the whole problem with our existing leadership discussion. It is not going to be solved by a new president.
Not a Ronald Reagan, not a George Bush, not a Jack Kennedy.
Not even President Carter or Jack Kennedy or any of the people. It is going to be solved by us changing things ourselves. And you need the sort of leadership that Lao Tzu talked about, where he said, if the leader leads well, the people said they did it themselves. So what we have to do is going back to people saying, I can make a difference. And, you know, I don't know if we can do that. There are a lot of traditions that make it less than impossible. This is a great volunteering culture. It's a great participatory culture. But we've sort of given up a bit. We've sort of said, oh, this is beyond us. Particularly our kids. Our kids are feeling completely overwhelmed. And when they do see new ideas in both the school and the college, they are told, but that isn't how things really are. You know, our whole schooling system reinforces the industrial era beliefs again. If you say, but that's not how the world works, people say, well, for the purposes of your education, that's how the world works.
Once again, you are listening to Bob Theobald. He is a British citizen, longtime resident of the United States, born in India, served in the British Army, was educated at Cambridge, and did further studies at Harvard. As I mentioned, he's the author of over 15 books, is a community consultant, also a hopeful realist. We'll ask him to define that as we go along a little later. I do want to ask you about the education system. It seems to me that you would argue that the focus and concentration generally of education is in error for the times in which we live. Do you agree with that, and what would you propose in its stead as most important priorities for education?
Well, I think this is an easy one. The educational system was designed to create people who knew how to take orders and to follow. That's what the industrial system required. The Germans, about 150 years ago, sat down and said, how do you create people who are willing to do what their bosses tell them? And they did a brilliant job.
So that we could create appropriate widgets or...
Widgets and watches.
Ciphers and books. And,
right, exactly. No. The problem is there are a very rapidly diminishing number of jobs which will work if all you know is to take orders. I was with Olin recently, and the vice president of Olin said, I need people who know how to cheat, which is an interesting way of putting it. He said, I cannot work with people who are loners. I need people who know how to cooperate. And it ties to my crack, which is basically when people come to school or university, they are told, we hope you will cooperate with each other, except during certain brief periods we will call exams. If you should be caught cooperating during an exam, in theory, you'll be out on your neck. Now, of course, if we threw all the people out who cheat in exams these days, we wouldn't have many people left in the university, but that's a whole other issue. The point is, our schools and colleges are designed to create people who are no longer relevant. So what people have to do is to learn to learn rather than just learn, because the world is changing so fast that if all they get is a body of knowledge, they're going to be obsolete in a very short period of time. Now, the interesting thing that's happening is that tech prep or voc ed or whatever you call that is learning that faster than the academic disciplines. Because your cycle around tech prep is so short, in a sense, if you throw out an auto mechanic and all he knows is how to do a particular car, he's going to be back in the system very rapidly and say, but the car, it doesn't work the way I was taught. Mm. Now, the problem is you can teach an economist nonsense. Sorry, anyone who's listening, I'm an economist. I have a right to
you
say that.
Say that. Yeah.
And people don't recognize until a lot later. I sometimes think we never recognize. Well, our economic models are nonsense at the moment. They have very little relevance to what we're trying to do. But we teach kids that. We say, you see, what we teach in academics is the implications which stem from a certain set of assumptions. Now, if the assumptions are no good, the conclusions are no good. Our assumptions come from 100 years ago. They come from a Newtonian model. Everybody knows that the Newtonian model is now a special case and a very trivial special case. What we are now dealing with is sometimes called chaos theory. Chaos theory is a totally different way of understanding how the world works. We're not teaching kids chaos theory. You could easily get through the university without ever hearing the word chaos theory. In fact, most kids probably don't. But chaos theory says that you have surface disorder and you have profound underlying order as a result of that surface or disorder. A couple of examples which may help. One of the implications of chaos theory is long-run weather forecasting is not just difficult, it's impossible. Because the result of chaos theory is you can never measure well enough that you won't get surprises a few days down the pike. It doesn't matter how close, because things move extraordinarily rapidly, that a depression or a small movement in Brazil, well, the one always is a butterfly's wing can create a hurricane, which may be a little exaggerated, but the point is it's really true. The other one which people don't realize is that a body which is stable is in deep trouble. If your heartbeat stays the same, even if you stay in the same conditions, you have not got a healthy body. So that there is intrinsic variation in your heartbeat. It may move 10-15% in 10 or 15 minutes, although you don't do anything different. And when it goes stable, that may be the best predictor of a heart attack. So it's a whole different way of looking at reality. It's an unstable, creative way of looking at it.
The two golden kernels in this body of information seem to me to be, one, you learn to learn right. in school, or you're not learning anything.
Right.
And the other is keep moving.
Keep moving.
Live in the moment, Baba Ram Dass.
Right, exactly. And don't bog down. Now, we had a wonderful example of this. I've been working with a community college in Illinois, and we eventually got a mission statement written. And the mission statement said that teachers ought to be learners. And fellow learners with the students. And the exciting thing was that one professor didn't do that with a student. And he said, I spent 2 days agonizing as to why I didn't do what my mission statement called for. So we actually changed the way that person thought about the educational process. It's doable. But it's so different because it's not, I have a body of knowledge and I can transfer that to you, but I can help you learn.
The world you're beginning to build on this radio program in the course of this 45 minutes or so now is I don't want to use the word chaotic, but it is less certain than the world we have emerged from. Will this society approach that less certain world, for example, teachers whose job it is to learn, with trepidation or with pleasure, or both?
I think it depends, again, largely on whether we help people understand that this alternative world is fun and that you have fun doing this and it's not all serious. One of the key words in this whole thing is fun. When I talk about the school, we need to do this with passion and compassion. If we don't do this, we will drive people back into fundamentalism. That's the great danger. If people become insecure, as they are, they look for certainty. They may find it in religion, they may find it in economics, they may find it in lots of places. But people then need to have things clear and certain. So we either, in a sense, allow them to take the step into living with uncertainty and finding that fun and creative, or people will go back and say, I really want it certain. And we see a lot of that happening. I mean, if you look at David Duke in my state of Louisiana, he is appealing to the people who say the world has become uncertain, unfair, and all of those things. And David Duke is not an isolated phenomenon. There are a lot of people who are saying, we can't cope with this. It's too uncertain. It's too unfair. And my wife has a wonderful line about David Duke. If you don't remember that he's saying the wrong things, he sounds very convincing. Because we have developed liberals, and I'll use that word, liberals are still using very obsolete ideologies. We are still, for example, saying that there's no problem with a welfare system which saps people's courage, drive, etc., etc., and there clearly is. Now, what you do about that's a different thing, but to deny that the welfare system is destructive of human dignity is pure stupidity, particularly in the context of the native situation, where more and more natives are saying, look, you better get this system out of here before we finally fall apart.
How do you image the future world if it comes to pass as you hope it will? Is this a world where there are lots of arguments and discussions and wrangles over every subject possible?
There's lots of discussion, and there's some real good arguments, but it's within the context of trust. You see, I think the purpose of building trust is so that I can say to you, well, I've listened to you, and I really can state what your argument is, and I still think you're crazy, and that doesn't blow our relationship up. Now, this is one place where there is a real problem. My wife's an anthropologist. I've learned an enormous amount from her. But she points out that one of the problems in this culture is that Americans find it extraordinarily difficult to take an idea out, put it on the table, and say, if it's a good idea, I'll look at it and put it back, and if it's a bad idea, I'll just take it out. Europeans are much better at that. Americans see their ideas as very much as part of their persona and who they are. And if this thing is going to work, people are going to have to get better at playing with ideas and saying, oh, yeah, now you've got a better idea than that. That's great. And the roundtable's doing some of that. And one of the things in this Illinois work that I noticed, which was absolutely fascinating, was we formed our groups. Everybody came in saying, I know what the answer is. You know, you're wrong. And in a 9-month process, people really began to appreciate the fact that you could see it a different way and not be crazy and not be wrong. And it led to good argument. Now, where energy comes from is good conflict. In other words, if you and I disagree, but we basically do, we're able to say, play off that, then good stuff happens. But at the moment, and in fact, it's a funny risk at the moment, as people move out of fighting, they tend to get into what I call the warm fuzzies. You know, we're not ever going to say anything that could conceivably upset anybody about anything. Now, then all the energy goes out of the room, because one of the images I'm just developing now is that, in a sense, a good culture is one where there are lots of waves on the top of the sea, and the whole job is to keep the waves coming, and that creates the energy. But the sea isn't roiled. Our trust levels aren't royal. The waves are royal, but underneath that, there's a real solid system which holds us together.
I do have a how do we get there from here question, and you've certainly explored it in your roundtable experience. But if we look at metropolitan areas in this nation, we don't see a great deal of trust. Folks don't say hey when they're walking down the street. They don't say hey to each other in the store. As I've mentioned before, there are double and triple locks on the door. Even in relatively rural areas, different factions, as you say, invest their persona in their positions, and there isn't a great deal of trust. So the first how do we get to here, there from here question is that.
Well, you see, I have a very simple statement. The human race can grow up or blow itself up. That simple. I don't know. What makes me, in a sense, frustrated is I believe there are a great many people who are ready to change styles. Now, you see, if you look at this really in a very global sense, up to now, cultures have operated because the old culture died, new culture came along and took its place. So if we were living in a pre-technological era, I'd be working in China or India or one of those countries and saying, well, let's help that country to be the next leader. When you have technological weapons, that model ain't going to work. And in a very real sense, I think that the Iraq war proved that. We are not prepared to give up. Unless America and the developed countries can understand the new way of moving, we will, in a sense, impose that with our nuclear weapons or our weapons. And I find it increasingly difficult to understand why chemical weapons are bad, nuclear weapons, we still don't have a ban on them. Or, I mean, some of these horrendous weapons that we have, which somehow are all right because they aren't quite nuclear. We, as a culture, are going to have to learn how to work with each other and care for each other, because otherwise we are going to blow ourselves up. Well, you mentioned I was a British citizen. I have been working here because I believe and still believe that America is the best hope for this change. But I have also become to the point where I am inclined to believe it is also the greatest danger. And it depends which way we now swing. Do the people who realize that we cannot afford to be a military giant and a military person or system take over? Or do we move further and further into, in a sense... See, for me, the new order, which is Bush's phrase, is simply British colonialism revisited. And what we're saying is the United States can make decisions about what are the right directions in the world. It didn't work with British colonialism. It certainly isn't going to work in the 1990s and the 21st century.
What do you mean when you say you're a hopeful realist?
I mean that I start from how I see reality, not from what I wish it were. how I see it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm right in all the ways I see it, but I don't dodge something. If I see that we have a crime rate which is going up because of the drug system, I say maybe we've got to think about drug decriminalization, because nobody I know has any belief that you're going to deal with the drug system by the police force methods we have at the current time. Hopeful, because I do believe that once you've done that, there are ways out of our messes. Not easy, not simple, but I believe people are a great deal more competent, great deal more caring than we're willing to give them credit for. One of my cracks about schools is if we would treat our kids as if they were twice as bright as we think they are, half our problems would vanish overnight. We underestimate people. We don't believe in them, and they're not given space to do what they're capable of doing. And in a sense, they respond in kind. They say, well, you don't trust us, we will show we're not trustworthy. I can show you corporations and industries which are moving towards trusting people. The results are incredible. You see some of that in education, not enough, and the results are again incredible. It's a question. Well, let me give you one wonderful example. There's a nun in New Orleans who takes slum kids, teaches them self-esteem, and by the end of the first year, those kids are saying to incomers, you do not fight in this school. They weren't taught not to fight in this school. They simply saw that given the way they saw the world, fighting was not a very intelligent answer.
And the next question is about being a futurist. I have read that you don't like labels, but if you'll promise not to run away from it here. What's the role of the futurist in a society? Is it to drag us forward, to put the mirror up?
There are at least as many definitions of futurist as there are futurists. Mm. But my definition of a futurist, and it makes me almost unique, and in fact a friend of mine put me into a book because of this, he said, I'm about the only person who knows who both looks at the big trends and talks about how do you communicate this to citizens. And so for me, a futurist is somebody who helps the citizen understand how the world can change, why the world has to change, and gets as much done within that context. I'm interested in changing the dynamics of the world in viable directions. So I have to know what's going on, because otherwise I'm going to propose things that aren't going to work. And then I have to listen to the citizen to find out what they're interested in doing with those technologies or those situations. What do you do with the fact that population is going up faster than we can manage? How do you manage the death issue? How are we going to deal with the fact that we're going to have to choose the point of death? And that does not mean euthanasia. People always get confused. I say we're talking about the right of people to choose to die with dignity, and I find myself increasingly puzzled about how a culture can deny that and put it into the law courts and make the messes we do about it.
You have faith?
I couldn't do this if I didn't believe it was possible. I don't believe it's certain. I think we have to get that tension in. Yes, we can do it, but it is going to depend on whether we try, each one of us. Each one of us is going to make that difference, not the big difference. I have another aphorism in the Rapids of Change, which I think helps me. Everything I do is critically important, and nothing I do matters a hill of beans. So, yeah, it's real important that we do this interview well. But it isn't going to change the world. Lots of us are going to have to do this. So, you, in a sense, and each one of us needs to work on which way, in a sense, our nature takes us. Does our nature take us into being self-important, in which case we need to remember that we're not that important? Or, on the other hand, does our nature take us into saying, well, of course, I don't make a contribution, in which case we need to wake up and say, each one of us has a lot more influence than we'd care to exercise. You see, in some ways, it's wonderful. If you can say, well, I can't make a difference, and you can just sit by and say, well, of course, if I were in charge, it would be different. But
Robert Theobald, thank you very much. You have been listening to Conversations. I promise to tell you what Action Linkage is. I promised this earlier, so I will tell you now. Robert Theobald is the founder of Action Linkage, a group started in 1969. It is called the oldest general-purpose networking organization in the United States, perhaps in the world, and was designed to support fundamental change and promote the exchange of knowledge. Action Linkage is based in Oakland, California. If you're looking for books by Robert Theobald, you will find a number of them. The most recent, The Rapids of Change, published in 1987, by Knowledge Systems, Inc. out of Indianapolis. You've been listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM. I hope to talk to you again next week.